We are here for After the Snow again this week. I'm your co-host, Dave Mays. Alongside me every week, we've been putting it in, Freeway Rick Ross.
Yes, yes. What's up, Dave?
Rick, what's going on, man?
Man, just, you know, rolling, man. Rolling, you know. Enjoying life.
I see it, man. I was happy to see you post some of your new gym routines that you're doing, on getting in on the weights and everything in there. That was a good look.
Yeah, my stomach got too big, man. You know, when I left prison, Dave, I would have 7% fat. I was ripped up. You know, some people say it was like a washboard. And, you know, now I look like I'm pregnant. So, you know, I said,
right.
You know, Rick, you put it off long enough. Let's get back in the gym, make some time. So, you know, I'm trying to do it. You know, I've been doing like 20, 30 minutes a day, maybe 40 sometimes, you know. Gradually, you know, working my way back in, you know, because I want to be fit. You know, I want to go to the swim parties and take my shirt off. And
I feel you. I've been doing the same thing, man. I've been hitting the gym pretty regularly last few years, and still got a lot of work to do, still at it. But yeah, it's a good thing to.
Yeah, I'm gonna go today after we finish with the podcast. That's exactly where I'm going is to the gym, get me a little bit in. My boy want to take me up to Stone Mountain. You know, I'm in Georgia today.
Okay, I heard you in Atlanta.
Yeah. I just miss you, man. We be just missing each other, man.
Right.
We probably flew past each other in the air last night.
Right. I left Atlanta yesterday in the afternoon. I was down there shooting new shows with Funny Marco for the Cornbread TV that everybody's loving out here. I flew back to Chicago yesterday while you were on your way in to Atlanta.
Yeah, that Marco series is going to be big, man.
Yeah, I think so, man. He's a talent, man. I love how he does his thing, what he does, and I'm just excited for him and for the response that we're getting to that Cornbread TV so far.
And Bill going to be big, too. Right on Hollywood Boulevard, man, that thing is like all windows. That was crazy last week, man. We had a crazy week last week.
Right. You know, we made TMZ for top billing with Bill Bellamy already. We haven't even launched. The show's going to launch in a couple more weeks. That's the name of it, Top Billing with Bill Bellamy. But, yeah, we had the TMZ tour buses pull up while he was with T.I.
John Sally, Too Short.
Yeah. All in,
you know what I'm saying? That was crazy. All in the same building.
Yeah. So, yeah, things are looking good for Breakbeat right now. We got a lot on the plate, but a lot of things are looking good, man. So, you know, and then you and I got a lot of other projects that we keep talking about. So we're going to have to.
The highlight, though, for me was me, you, and Brett being together, man. I thought that was the dopest show we did so far.
Definitely.
I don't know what everybody else thinks, but I thought it was dope. And I hope that we can do it again soon because it was, you know, for me, it was just the most amazing show that we did so far. And I can't wait till we get to sit in a room like that again.
Anyone that missed it, that was last week's episode of After the Snow. First time we were all together in L.A. But I think, you know, that could happen more often, you know, with us doing the Bill Bellamy show out there. We're going to probably be doing shows once a week with him. So, you know, maybe we can just set it up where we can do the podcast while we're all, you know, while Brett and I are in L.A. with you. So that'd be amazing. Shout out to Brett. Our other co-host, Brett Jeffries. We miss you already.
Yes. Shout out to Brett. Yeah. But I thought that was one of the most amazing shows we did. And you know, even though all the other people was there, for me, my highlight of the week was that right there, man. Just, you know, being there.
Dope. That's good to hear, man.
And I'm on my way to St. Louis, too. You know, we got a fight this weekend in St. Louis. You know, I'll be down there promoting fights. And anybody in St. Louis, hit me up. Come out. Support.
Yeah, the Lou. Definitely. They're celebrating their guy, Jason Tatum, right now, who's doing his thing for the Boston Celtics, who went up 2-1 last night in the series. So
yeah, I thought Golden State was gonna have an easy time with them, man. But
I guess
get at that level, ain't nothing easy.
Nah, those boys are tough. Yeah, between Tatum and Jaylen Brown, but they got some guys around them too that are doing their thing. Marcus Smart, the Williamses, those guys are killing them. So we'll see. I'm sure Golden State gonna regroup. Should be a good game. What's the next one? Maybe tomorrow.
Golden State got to try to get that home court advantage back.
Exactly.
They lost home court advantage the first night, so you know they got an uphill battle now.
Yeah, Nelly performed last night at the Boston, in Boston at the game at halftime. You know, he's from St. Louis, of course. So him and Jason Tatum hooked that up.
That was dope.
Yeah, yeah, they seem to be friends.
Yeah, that's dope.
Yeah, yeah. So,
man, you ready to get into this show, man?
Yeah, let's do it. Let's do what we do. Let's talk about this week's episode of Snowfall. And, of course, we're back at season one. We're now talking about episode 6 of season one. You know, it's an interesting episode. Things are, you know, moving along. With our main, you know, storylines following, you know, Franklin, following Oso and Lucia, and of course, you know, Teddy and Alejandro, and all the other characters that come into play on those main characters' kind of journeys that we're watching so far. I think the first thing we see, one of the first things we see is Franklin counting the money out with his boys at the crib. They're going crazy, throwing the money all over the place and everything. And of course, the girl next door, Melody, pops up, and you know she's already in the know about what's going on and everything. But everybody wants to try using the product.
And yeah, man, and that was one of the things that stood out to me. You know, with my crew when I started, I'd already been kind of like educated on about using, you know, because some of the pimps had been telling me, you know, whatever you do, don't use. If you don't use, you'll get rich, and those things kind of stuck in my mind. But for my boys, they didn't get the same type of lessons that I got. They got it from me, you know, where I was telling them, man, don't use. And, you know, lo and behold, behind my back, they had been using, and it took a while. You know, it take a while before you can discover that somebody's been using cocaine. You know, it's not, it don't have the obvious signs that some of the other drugs might have, you know, where you can just straight see right off the bat that they already using drugs. So, his guys was acting a little weird, and I guess Franklin picked up on it, and he questioned them in there about them using. None of them admitted it, but something was going on with them.
Definitely. Did you have like rules with people like that they couldn't do it, or you just had to try to monitor it?
You know, Dave, when I started, I was young. You know, I don't know nothing about rules, you know. Mm-hmm. Cocaine to me was totally new. You know, yeah. I didn't, you know, when I first got a hold of cocaine, I didn't even know if it was real cocaine or not. You know, my first job was to figure out, was it real? Mm-hmm. You know, was it really cocaine or some baby powder? So, here I am learning by trial and error. So, you know, I had enough sense to tell my guys not to use, but, you know, I never sit down and had a meeting with them. I didn't start having meetings with my guys a couple years after I had been in the business for a while, you know. Mm. So as far as sitting them down and telling them, hey, you can't use. If you use, you're going to get fired. No, I didn't do that. It was more like, man, TQ and them said, don't use this stuff, even though TQ used. But he knew enough about it to tell me not to use. You know, he knew that it was holding him down from his goals. And several people told me that. So that always stuck in the back of my mind. even though, you know, I tried it for about a week. You know, I went about a week straight, maybe 2 weeks, you know, where I was snorting, and then we started smoking the weed in Primos. But I got sick at the end of the whatever the period was that I went through it. I got sick, lucky for me. And I realized that I could never do it again. When I started, I had about maybe $3,000, close to $4,000. And when I caught myself, I think I was down to about $300 or $400. So I also saw that, you know, using and the money didn't go together. They didn't go hand in hand. So I was able to quit right after that period. And I vowed to myself, you know, that I would never use again.
Was there something that happened, or what was the transition point to where you started to get a little more organized? Like you said, the first couple of years, it wasn't that organized, but then you started having meetings and implementing structure. What was there something that precipitated that?
Well, you know, once you start having money, you know, money buys knowledge. You know, it buys you friends with information. And so I started to meet people that were more organized, you know, more business savvy. And I just started learning from them, you know, what they were doing in their businesses and how they organized their businesses. But my business was really ragtail from the beginning. You know, you're talking about, 19, 20 year old kid. Never read a book, you know, didn't watch the news, you know, probably my favorite shows on TV at that time probably was cartoons and westerns. So my knowledge of business was very limited, even though I had the desire to be a businessman. You know, I used to volunteer every summer to go to Texas to work with my uncles, you know, in the country, and they did brutal work. So I guess I kind of got part of my work ethic from around them, you know, seeing how hard they went, and maybe some of my organizing skills too, even though they weren't real, real organized, you know, but they were the most organized people that I'd ever been around. Let me say that.
So I was going to say this kind of question topic to later in the show, but you're already kind of getting into some of the things that I wanted to talk about. So let's get into it. You know, one of the things I'm looking at with this episode and what's happened is, you know, Franklin is still at it, and look at everything he's been through. You know, getting beat up and robbed. He gets beat up again in this episode. You know, he's standing in front of a crazy Israeli guy, you know, shooting at him. You know, he's putting his mom in danger. His uncle's telling him, you know, stay away from this. This ain't, you know, going to be good for you, all this stuff. And yet and still, keeps going. He's, you know, he's had some second thoughts, but he keeps going, and he's really, you know, pursuing, you know, to the extreme, like we were talking about earlier. He shows up in the Mexican neighborhood by himself, which is crazy. But that's how, again, it just shows how driven he is to want to make this work. So my question was, like, why? What is it about him, or in your case, you know,
my beginning wasn't that bad. Nobody beat me up. The worst thing happened to me is my guy Martin beat me out of my first pack. And that was normal in the cocaine business, you know, especially at the small level, because what you realize is that everybody you're dealing with is users. Most of the people that you're dealing with are users, so they're going to be figuring out a way how to get some coke out of your pack to put in their nose on their pipe. So my drive didn't go through what he went through. You know, I never got beat up. Nobody never shot at me. I didn't have to shoot at anybody. You know, it wasn't that hard. What they got him going through is some of the things of is to me is out of ignorance, you know, out of naive. You know, I would never just walk around with cocaine. You know, when I had cocaine, I had a specific place it was going. You know, it was already designated to a place. I guess you could call that a plan in a sense, you know, because I just didn't move around with cocaine in my car. You know, that was for us, that was a no-no, because we understood in L.A., you know, you might just be riding down the street and the cops see you and decide to pull you over.
Right.
So you would never just open yourself up for those type of opportunities. You don't get a cops those kind of opportunities, you know, that you got something in the car and they pull you over and they just get it. You know, they get what we call a freebie.
So how would, when you think back about it, how would you describe your motivation in those first few years? Like what was it that was driving you to keep pursuing this? And then go ahead. I got one more question. I'll follow up after you answer.
Well, mine was driven by wanting to be out of poverty. I didn't like being poor. I didn't like going to the store with food stamps. You know, when my mama used to send me to the store with food stamps, I would hide in the store until all my friends was gone before I would go up to the counter and pay, because I didn't like being on welfare. I hated being on welfare. I hated being poor. I hated not having. I hated my siblings not being able to have the things that they want. So mine was driven more out of running from poverty, I would say. And I was willing to put it all on the line for that. But not just in the cocaine business. I did the same thing in the car. When I stole cars, you know, I can remember when I was writing my book and one night I woke up in my bed cell and I was just like totally like sweating and everything. And it was this scene that I went through and, I was a little guy, so when I started stealing cars with these guys, I did all the dirty work, especially the dirty work that it took a little guy to do. So one night we're stealing this car, and the car was right up under the person's window who car it was, and their window was open. So what we had to do is we had to door lock the door, you know, open the door up, take the back seat out, and then I had to crawl through the back seat to open the trunk up. And this night that I had the dream, I woke up and I opened the trunk and it wasn't my friend standing there. It was the owner of the car standing there with a gun in my face. So I had been taking those type of chances already. Matter of fact, I have probably been taking worse chances stealing cars than I was even in the coke game.
Hmm.
Now, but then I knew you don't go to East L.A. uninvited trying to sell no dope to no Mexicans. You just right. Don't do that, you know,
right.
That. Because it's been this rival between blacks and Mexicans since I can remember, you know. Even we played tennis one time. I remember we played tennis and we had caught the bus to Griffin Park to a tournament, me and about three of our friends. And we stayed at the tournament too late. The buses wasn't running no more. So we had to walk home, and from our walk home, we had to go through a Mexican neighborhood and they saw us and about 20 guys chased us. Lucky we was tennis players and in great shape. Otherwise I might've got that beat down that we seen Franklin just about.
Oh, wow.
So, you know, being from LA, you know, that those are known, that's a no-no.
Okay. So another part of it that I think is interesting to talk about and think about is, and this might have been last episode, but there's a part where Franklin is talking to his uncle Jerome about things. And he's like, you know, says something about how, look, you know, the system is fixed against us and, you know, it's all corrupt, that type of thing. And so where does that fit into things at this, you know, at this stage when you're getting into it? Like, how much of your motivation, you know, we know it's to make money and break the poverty cycle, but where does that fit in? Were there ever thoughts of like, you know, man, you know, the whole system is rigged against us. So, you know, I got to do what I got to do to survive.
Well, I can't necessarily say that I felt that the system was rigged against me. I had some disabilities that stopped me from being able to function in the system. You know, even though I probably would have been a great worker for whoever hired me, but my inability to fill out an application made me unemployable. So, and I knew that those were things that were against me, and probably my size too, because I still was a little guy when I first started selling drugs. I've always kind of been small, you know, in high school and everything. But it was a job that my brothers took that they say that I was too small to take. You know, they were working at a metal factory, and I wanted to work there as well, but they said that I was too small to take the job. The job was too strenuous for somebody my size. So, but for the most part, my inability to read and write is what made me kind of like where I almost had to go to something illegal to exercise my skills, to show my ability to handle money, my ability to organize, my ability to be honest to myself. Even though I stole cars, you know, I always tried to be fair with the people that I was stealing the cars with. You know, I never wanted to beat them out of their cut or anything like that there. So it's like when the guys that I started stealing cars with, Dirty Benny, he goes to jail. Him and Jake both goes to jail, you know, early on. And I took all their connections that they had and I started making money with them. So when they got out of jail, you know, I looked out for them.
So Franklin's determination to, you know, succeed leads him to go to his uncle and ask for some more help and ask, you know, for a connection. And so Uncle Jerome and Aunt Louie decide, you know, we're going to introduce him to Knees, is his name. And they take him to see old man Knees, who is a new character played by the actor Bokeem Woodbine. And I wanted to talk about Bokeem because, you know, he's been a staple in the hip hop culture, you know, for almost 30 years now, been in so many, you know, movies and so much, you know, connected to the hip hop culture over the years. He got his start actually as like a extra in the movie Juice with Tupac back in 92. And then he got one of his first major roles in Jason's Lyric. He was in Dead Presidents and Crooklyn, and he became friends with Tupac. You might remember he was in the I Ain't Mad at Your video with Tupac. And I think he actually acted in the last movie. Tupac was in Gridlocked as well. They were working together on that. So, yeah, man, it was good to see him. He plays this, you know, this old guy that Franklin is trying to get him to give him information on a connection to the Mexicans.
Well, you know, first they took him over there to discourage him from selling cocaine.
Well, yeah, that's true.
Remember, that was the initial introduction was his uncle. And it was kind of funny. I had, you know, how his uncle introduced him and was talking to him, you know, it didn't seem real. You know, the way the conversation was going. But anyway, you know, he talked about them killing his friend in front of him and the bullet going through his friend and hitting him in the nut.
Yeah.
You know, yeah. And that's how the whole conversation started. And what I was wondering now, they didn't really clarify it, but are they talking about the same Mexicans that these are the same people that he introduced, where he gives Franklin a number to?
Yeah, when he goes later on to that neighborhood, that's the address that that Knees gave him, right?
Yeah, so he would go and talk to a guy, some guys who just killed
one of his guys. Yeah, well, I guess yeah.
It just seems crazy. You know, in the real drug world, you just don't do stuff like that.
Yeah, they were definitely trying to discourage him, but in the end, you know, he gave up the info for $1,000 to Franklin. But he also was telling an interesting story I wanted to touch on real quick, where he goes into this thing telling Franklin how, you know, we didn't used to have gangs back in the day. It started as clubs to protect the community in the 50s from, I think he called them the spook hunters, which were, I guess, you know, white folks that were coming into the black neighborhoods and committing, you know, violence and crimes. And so he talked about how that's how, you know, there weren't gangs. And then he talks about the 60s, which we talked about last week, and kind of the movement with the Black Panthers and, you know, how the communities and black folks were getting organized. And Franklin interjects, yeah, I know about all that. The FBI came in and messed everything up. So basically he was saying that, like, the FBI's interference, the COINTELPRO stuff with the black power movements of the 60s is what led to the emergence of violent street gangs. So I thought that was interesting. Wanted to see what your take was on that.
Well, you know, I've been looking into that for a while, and it just so happens that I got three partners that just got out of jail doing like 35, 45, I mean, crazy numbers, you know, Crips, original Crips, guys who ran with Tookie and Raymond Washington. I'm talking about real guys, not guys who say they Crips and these guys got the rap sheets and the police reports and everything to show, the document where they been with it. But I definitely want to figure out, how did it all take place? You know, what really happened? Where did it go wrong? Where did it get twisted? Because I do know, I remember when the Black Panthers, I saw the Black Panthers march in L.A. I was young, you know, maybe 5-6 years old, but I can remember the days the Black Panthers marched through L.A. And, you know, I remember when Watts was on fire. You know, I actually saw that. Me and my mom, we were standing Watts at the time. So I experienced a lot of that. Did the FBI penetrate them? I'm sure they did, but to what extent? And to where it turned from us trying to protect our neighborhoods to us destroying our neighborhoods. That's a question that I want to figure out.
All right. Well, that's another Breakbeat Media exclusive coming up that we got to start working on, you know, because, you know, we got our kind of documentary podcast that we're doing, investigative and documentary stuff. We haven't released anything yet, but the first one is the Unsigned Hype story, which tells the whole backstory of that column from the Source magazine, 8 episodes that'll be out starting in late July. And then we got the Larry Hoover story we've talked about. We're working on that and getting close to getting that finished up and putting that out towards the end of the summer. So
yeah, Larry Hoover, that one is going to be true.
Yeah.
Fire.
Yeah. I still need to catch up with a couple of your people that we talked about so we can, you know, get them into the podcast conversation. So we'll talk about that. But
no doubt. And another thing that they stole this from me. You know, when I first started, but they flipped it in the show. They flipped it. When I first started, all the guys were telling me that I couldn't sell cocaine in the hood. You know, they were like, ain't nobody over here got money to buy cocaine. You know, back then, a gram of cocaine was like $150. I mean, $350 for 1 gram. I mean, it was like really, really expensive. So in the show, you know, Unc, he tell Franklin, he say, well, the only safe place to sell it is in the hood, just like I do with my weed. So they kind of flipped it a little bit, you know, twisted it around a little bit. I was like, man, they got that from me.
Right. Because I think he actually said after that, that, you know, but they don't have the money for it, which is what you're saying, the same message. Yeah. You kind of got that it wouldn't work.
Yeah. That's what everybody, all the guys who were selling PCP, that's what they were telling me, you know, even though they were smoking cocaine while they were telling me, oh man, it ain't gonna work. And then they smoking cocaine. So, cause you know, that's what I did. I fed off the PCP sellers for a while, mm-hmm. you know, like every time they make $100, they come spend 20 with me, you know, to get high. So they could stay out there long. Oh, I'm just hitting so I can stay up tonight. You know, I'm gonna stay out here a little longer tonight. So I'm gonna take me a little blast.
Okay. They could afford it. They would shoot one of the people that could afford it.
It was only at that time, it was only a few people, you know, the pimps could afford it. The PCP sellers could afford it. The weed dealers could afford it. So at that time, those were my main customers until later on, you start getting some entertainers, you know, a few lawyers, a few doctors, and then people who had really good jobs, you know, like post office workers. And I could gradually see how, as the price came down, more and more lower income people had started to get involved.
Yeah.
But you know, Dave, go ahead.
No, go ahead, Rick.
But you know, most of the people who got involved, they didn't get involved to use. They got involved to make some money. Right. Even with Franklin guys, if we remembered, they really right now they're really thinking about making the money. They really want the money, but they're also curious about what the high is like.
Right.
You remember that's their curiosity. Well, what is it like? How you gonna sell it if you don't know what you're selling? You know what I'm saying? And this is the stuff that turns people into addicts because they go into it to make the money, you know, because everybody need a little extra money. You know, everybody do. But they start to sample with, just like I did when I first tried it, I started to sample with it just to see, you know, all my guys is telling me how good it is. And, you know, so then once you sampled it, you know, and a lot of people, if you're not really strong, you're going to be gone.
Yeah. So it's interesting. You know, you're talking about kind of the way you had to build your business in the beginning. And that's what we're seeing kind of in this episode where everybody's trying to figure out how they can unload this product. You know, all of a sudden, this guy Alejandro, I guess, has popped up working with the CIA and he's flooding, you know, cocaine into LA or making it available in mass quantities at, you know, I guess, you know, discount prices. So you got people like Franklin and Lucia, and also everybody's chasing this opportunity, but they're all trying to find how are we going to move this stuff. And all roads end up leading to Stomper, the head of the Mexican gang. They call them Los Monarcas in the TV show. I'm pretty sure that's just a name they made up. But so it's basically presented that the Mexicans really had, and the cartels really had the cocaine game locked down, and that, you know, there wasn't opportunities if you didn't go through the Mexicans. So I wanted to hear your thoughts about that and your experience with that as well.
Well, not in the 80s. No, blacks had the cocaine locked up. I mean, everybody was coming to South Central, you know, we have people coming from all around the country, you know, coming to South Central to cop, you know, most of the guys that we hear about on TV and on the news, you know, started right in LA. It's amazing how, you know, I say that cocaine have legs. It travels, you know, from LA to Chicago, from Chicago to Minnesota to Milwaukee, you know, it just has a way to travel. But in the 80s, it was definitely the blacks. It was only after the feds rounded up all of the players, you know, that the Hispanics started to take over.
So that's interesting.
The Colombians was coming straight to LA, you know, they was coming straight to LA with it. And the Nicaraguans really kicked it off. But then once the Nicaraguans got it started and the market was there, then the Colombians, you know, I guess they just heard about it and they start coming directly to LA. And that's how some of the other guys who came up, you know, got their connections, because the Colombians was running around L.A. looking for customers. But, you know, after we all went to jail, they started dealing with gangbangers, and, you know, guys started robbing them, taking all the cocaine. You know, when we was in jail, we were hearing about people, you know, taking 300 keys from the Colombians.
So that's interesting now that we're talking about it in this way and perspective. Like, you know, the show is making it seem like the Mexicans were the kind of people, you know, that were really funneling the cocaine and controlling the cocaine. But you're saying that isn't true. And kind of what that does in the TV show is sort of diminish the facts and the realities around the government's plan to push cocaine into all the black neighborhoods. Even what you were just saying, people from all over the country were coming to South Central to cop the cocaine. And all this activity was centered around black inner city black communities. And the government was sitting at the top here, kind of pushing the button to allow all that to happen. At least that's, you know, what many people believe. And there's a lot of, you know, facts to support that. So it's interesting that the TV show in this way is kind of deflecting the attention from that narrative.
Well, you know, like we said previously, these people didn't live in L.A. You know, they didn't have the real players. They don't have guys who really lived in this life, you know, was in the circle, you know, assisting them. You know, they have people who was around, was about, but nobody who really was inside, you know, shaking and baking and really helping them. And yeah. That's why they would allow. And then I guess, too, you know, they don't really care about the truth. You know, it don't have to be truthful. It just has to be captivating, you know, where the audience will go, wow, you know. Because if it was, you know, I mean, if it was a righteous story, they would be looking for the black players in the, you know, in the game, you know, the Harry O's, the Bo Bennett's, the Young Tommies, the Freeway Ricks, the Big Ted's. You know, there was a lot of guys that carried a lot of weight in L.A.
Right. And that, I don't want to give away too much, but that's kind of the thing you've talked about before of how you could do a different type of a series that would be more focused around, you know, those guys and that whole scene and the reality in that era than what we're seeing on here. Because, you know, as much as I give credit to the show for putting light on some of these realities, I always still in the back of my mind, I'm feeling like, well, somebody's got to come in there and adjusting the narratives a little bit, you know, to try not to push it too far or like I said, you know, diminish, you know, this part of the story, you know, that there's somebody that's guiding that behind the scenes, you know.
Well, you know, Dave, one of my problems with Hollywood is that they never tell true black stories. You know, true. And that's why it's taken me so long with my movie to get it out, because, you know, I want a true black story. You know, I want it to be told just like it was. They don't like to show us in a smart light. You know, even though, you know, I was illiterate, I couldn't read, I couldn't write. You know, I did a lot of things that was smart, you know, inside of my coke dealing. Things that, you know, if it would have went the wrong way, you know, I could never get out of prison. You know, it was times that, you know, my guys, because, you know, some of my guys were gangbangers. You know, they had a gangbanger mentality. And the first thing they want to do is go kill everybody. You know, and I had to be smart enough and strong enough to stand up to them and be like, hold up, let's weigh this thing out. Let's look at this whole scenario. And without those things being in place, you know, who knows where me and most of my crew would be at right now today.
Yeah.
And I think that those are the things that people want to see. You know, people want true reality, you know. And I just, you know, I just don't see that inside of, you know, like with the guys that robbed Franklin, you know, they sitting on the street trying to rob him. The cops would, if that would have been a cop and he saw those guys there, he would have took them out the car. You know, he'd have called back up. They'd have been stretched out on the street. You know what I'm saying? They'd have found a gun. It just that's not real to see a cop who's suspecting somebody of doing something and not taking action, especially in L.A. L.A., it didn't go down like that. I mean, even if it was a black cop, he still would have had you stretched out on the ground because I guess what the black cops used to do, it was this cop named J.C. Miller, and he worked on the Freeway Rick Ross task force. You know, they put this task force together to catch me because they couldn't figure out who I was or how I was getting away with it. You know, this guy would be the one who beat everybody up. Right. He would be the one hitting you in the head with the flashlight, you know, I guess to appease his peers and let them know that he was one of the guys, you know, and he was dedicated to the cause.
Yeah, well, that's another interesting point that supports kind of what I was just saying, like that there's parts of the narrative that aren't being told correctly that are super important, like the way so far we've seen the police depicted. You're saying it just... it isn't real, and then they're taking again a little bit of the focus off of, you know, the brutality, the you know, illegal nature of what, you know, the LAPD and officers have been involved in for so long, and especially back then, you know, that's not really being highlighted prominently as it could be in this early stage of the Snowfall, you know, story.
Yes, and that's what I was trying to say, that they're just not putting it there, and you know, they could have, you know, and they should have. I mean, if you go tell it, because people know that this is a real story. You know, they know that parts of this is real, but they can't figure out what's real and what's not real.
Right.
And that's why we're here. And that's why we're here.
Exactly. I don't know what I was about to say. I don't want to say, you know, keep saying the same thing, but that's what why we're here. That's what Breakbeat is about. It's about creating a platform that's going to bring people the real information, the truth, the authentic stories, you know, not sugarcoating it, not having an agenda to, you know, cut out certain parts of it, but, you know, bring it to you real and raw. And I think that's what people really want at the end of the day. You know, despite the way this world is heading with social media and all the kind of shenanigans that go on in social media, I think, you know, authenticity, if it's true authenticity, is really valued. And that's, you know, that's what Breakbeat is about, being authentically hip hop. So, you know, I'm really proud to have you as part of the Breakbeat family, Rick. And, you know, definitely want to keep this show going and keep doing more things together. And hopefully our listeners and viewers out there, you know, can feel us and relate to, you know, what we're doing and what we're trying to do.
I think they are. You know, when I go out to the events, you know, I'd be shocked. People come up and say, man, I watch After the Snow every time, you know, every episode. So, you know, I didn't really know, you know, how it was going to work out when you approached me about doing this show. But now, you know, I'm getting more into it. I'm starting to feel it. I'm excited about doing it. And I think it's going to be a great thing for people, not just, for us, but for people to really see how Hollywood will take a story or an event and twist it to their narrative and not give it to the people the way that it should be given to them.
Yeah. Well, on that note, I think we can wrap up this week's episode. And again, thank everyone. I'm your co-host, Dave Mays, and this is After the Snow. We're part of the Breakbeat podcast network. And we come to you every week. We talk about an episode of the TV show Snowfall. This week we just did season 1, episode 6. So we'll be back next week with episode 7. And who knows where we'll be next week when we do the show. I'm in Chicago today. Rick's in Atlanta, but things are a lot of movement for both of us these days.
Yes, yes, yes. I'm on my way to St. Louis too. St. Louis, stand up. I'll be there this weekend. Come check me out. Boxing matches. Yeah, man, it's just been a wonderful day. And we're just going to keep pushing this thing, man, and see where it goes. I know that sooner or later they're going to catch on to what we're doing, and they're going to appreciate what we're doing, man, because we need somebody out here with the truth, man. There's too much falsehood and too much faking and shaking out here, man. We need the real.
That's right. All right. Well, on that note, we'll see y'all next week. Peace out.
Peace.